Hey everybody, it's Brock Falk, and I want to thank you for listening to this message from Heritage Church of Christ. We would be thrilled to share more content like this with you and make it easy for you to share it with others. You can find more messages like this on our podcast, or you can download our smartphone app by searching for Heritage Church of Christ in your app store. But most importantly, I hope this message encourages you to take a next step toward a thriving relationship with Jesus. Enjoy.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Brock. Some of you I haven't had a chance to meet before, but I'm thrilled that you're here today. I have a question for you. How many of you have ever had a job where you had to wear a uniform to work? All right. Anybody? Yeah. Share that with your neighbor. Tell them about what job you had that you had to wear a uniform to go to work. I'm sure there are some adventurous ones out there. I've had a few of those kinds of jobs, too. When I was in high school, I worked for Target for a bunch of years, so you can imagine the red and khaki every single day. You know, like, I still can't wear that nowadays. I'm just so sick of it. It's been all these years later. I had a job in college where I was working on oil pump jacks, and so it was just coveralls that were covered in grease and oil and paint all the time, and it was pretty nasty. But you can kind of tell a lot about a job from a uniform. In fact, if I was to describe for you a uniform that somebody wears to work, you probably could do a pretty good job of guessing what kind of work it is that they do. You know, like, here's one. If I was to tell you about somebody who wore a shirt with a big number on the front and a helmet with a face mask and a mouth guard and shoulder pads underneath the shirt, you would know I was talking about football play. That's good. And if you missed that, some of you up here in the front that said golfer, you need more coffee. You need more coffee. That's just how it is. Like, that was an easy one. But if I told you about somebody that wears latex gloves and a mask over their nose and mouth and scrubs and a bonnet hat to work, you would know I was talking about a lunch lady. That's good. I didn't think about that one. That was, somebody Instagram that right now. That was awesome. Way to go. If I was to describe somebody that wore a Kevlar vest and pants and big black boots and a hat with a wide brim in the back and carried an axe and wore a face mask and had gloves and had an air tank on their back, you guys tell me, what am I describing? You're making up stuff now. This is awesome. Talking about a firefighter. And just by looking, I mean, yeah, some of these things are really recognizable, but they don't wear that so that they'll be recognizable. They wear that stuff because every piece of that equipment is critical to the job that they do. Every piece of that equipment is really important for the environment where they're going to be doing their job. They need to be equipped and protected during some really intense moments and facing some incredible heat and terrible environment. In fact, you know, it would be foolish for a firefighter to walk into a burning building without wearing all that stuff, right? You wouldn't want to walk into an area where there was fire, active fire going on, without wearing at least that much protective gear. And we know that for certain jobs, regardless of what industry it's in, there are certain jobs where the equipment that you wear, the uniform that you wear, is a really important part of getting the job done well and getting the job done safely. Now, in the series that we've been working our way through in our sermons for the last few weeks, we've been talking about the uniform that fits a follower of Jesus. In fact, we've been taking a deep dive into a passage from the New Testament, from the book of Ephesians, where we've been talking about what Paul refers to as the armor of God. And what we've been saying here is that this armor, this uniform that fits a follower of Jesus, is so important that we wouldn't want to go into any day in our life without wearing it. But the fact is, the reality is that sometimes we walk into fires in our life. Sometimes we walk into situations in our life where we need to be letting God lead the way. We need to be trusting God. We need to be standing behind God. And yet we're going into some of those situations without taking the equipment that we need. And so I want us to talk a little bit more about this uniform today. And I hope you'll open your Bible and join me in Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians is in the New Testament. that portion of your Bible. It's a letter. It's 2,000 years old. It was written by one of the earliest church leaders to a group of first generation and a few second generation Christians. And he's trying to encourage them and equip them for the difficult journey of living out their faith in a culture that was pretty hostile to Christianity, because Christianity was new and mysterious and suspicious, and they had a difficult task ahead of them. And part of what Paul is trying to communicate over and over in this letter in Ephesians is, he says, the Christian life is risky. Which probably shouldn't be too surprising to us, considering what happened to its founder, right? But it is a little bit unexpected for some of us. We should not be surprised to think that living the life like Jesus led might cause some problems for us, right? Because that happened to Jesus. But Paul is explaining it and informing his students, his pupils here, and he's saying to them, listen, the life that you've been called to and invited to, the life that you've chosen, it's a life that's full of risk. In fact, he says, it's not just like accidents that could happen. He says, the devil, the forces of evil in the spiritual realm are relentless about attacking God's people and undermining their faith. He says, God's people are always under attack in this life. That is going to be a reality. And in fact, he says, if we're going to endure, if we're going to live through, if we're going to stand in the midst of the attacks that come our way, he says, we better be equipped, just like the firefighter. We'd better be prepared for the challenges that we're going to face. And he refers to this equipment metaphorically as the armor of God. Now, so far in this series, and in case you've missed a couple of the messages, we've talked about a few specific pieces of the armor. We've talked about the belt of truth and the breastplate of righteousness, these two important pieces of equipment that guard our hearts against the lies of Satan, and they rob evil of its intimidating power. And last week, we talked about fitting our feet with what Paul called the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. And he was talking about this, allowing peace to help us stand our ground even when we feel anxious because we're under attack. And this series so far has been a really good reminder to us that our lives are spiritually under siege. Now, don't think for a minute. Don't think for a second when I say that our faith is under attack, that I'm talking about some kind of attack against religious liberties or something like that. That's the farthest from what we're talking about today. When I say our faith is under attack, I'm talking about your connection to God, your pursuit of God, and my pursuit of God actually being derailed or distracted by the difficulties that we face in this life. Paul is trying to tell us there is an intentional, strategic effort underway trying to undermine your dependence, reliance, and faith on God. Even though we serve a God who never, never stops pursuing His people, the reality is that sometimes God's people stop pursuing God, right? God never stops pursuing us. God never severs the relationship with us, but sometimes we stop pursuing our God. And you and I both know people who in our lives who have been casualties of spiritual warfare, don't we? We know people, we can name people in our life who were committed to God, but then their faith got off track. They got distracted, they got discouraged, and eventually their faith got derailed. You know some people that happened because some tragedy happened in their life. Some great loss of a dream or a relationship or a person. Something was lost in their life and it blindsided them and their faith never recovered from that event. Some of you know people who, boy, their faith was just an inspiration to everybody else in their life, but suddenly this seed of doubt started to take root and they started to have a difficulty reconciling. Somebody planted a seed of doubt in their mind that said that faith can't be reconciled with science or that scripture can't be reconciled with history and things like that. And it was like pulling a foundation out of the house of cards that their faith was built on and everything came falling down. You and I know people like that. People who, they didn't go looking to destroy their faith. They didn't want that to happen, but it did happen. And the question I want us to ask ourselves this morning is, how do you avoid becoming a casualty of spiritual warfare? How do you avoid becoming someone who just is a statistic of those that walked away from their connection with God? How do we prevent the evil one from distracting us from the one pursuit that ultimately matters? Well, I want to remind you what Paul had to say in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 13. He says, put on every piece of God's armor, so that you'll be able to resist the enemy in the time of evil. He says there's a day that's coming. There's a time that's coming in your life. And for many of us, we can look back on the history of our calendars and say, that's a day when evil showed up. That's a day when things really fell apart. That's a day when life was really challenging. And Paul says, put on the full armor of God, so on those days and the ones like them that are to come, you will be able to resist the enemy in the time of evil. He says, then after the battle is over, after that particular skirmish is over, he says, you'll be able to stand. Paul is trying to say, listen, follower of Jesus, you can prepare for the difficult days that are ahead. It doesn't have to blindside you. It doesn't have to come when you're totally not ready or not expecting it. You can be prepared for the difficult days that are coming. He says we can guard against our faith's vulnerabilities. And if we prepare ahead of time, if we get ready before that moment happens, then he says we'll be able to stand against the difficulty. And so today we're looking at two more pieces of the armor of God that Paul describes in verses 16 and 17. Here's what he says. He says, in addition to all of those other pieces we've already talked about, in addition to everything else I've already mentioned, he says, in addition to those, hold up the shield of faith to stop the fiery arrows of the devil. And then in the first few words of verse 17, he says, also put on salvation as your helmet. Okay, this shield of faith and the helmet of salvation. Two of the most vital pieces of God's armor that Paul mentions in this passage. And I want us to talk about them today. And to do that, to illustrate that, I want us to look back, like we've been doing, at an episode from the life of David. Only this time it's going to be a little bit different. This time, instead of showing you a moment when David demonstrated this reliance on God, demonstrated this faith in God, I want to show you a tragedy story. I want to show you one of the moments that's a story of what not to do, an example of what happens when you let down your guard, when you drop the shield of faith, when you're not wearing the helmet of salvation and the defenses that you had up in your spiritual fight are not effective at all. You see, throughout all the stories that we've read about David so far, time and time again, he has shown up as this hero of the faith. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we read about him walking bravely onto a battlefield all by himself to face a giant, a guy who was three times his size, and he was hardly armed, hardly prepared, but because he knew God was on his side, he walked out there with confidence and with intention, and he won the battle. And I mean, he was just this picture of confident faith. And then the next week we talked about his integrity. He's hiding in a cave and his adversary, Saul, who's chasing him, comes into the cave by himself, totally unaware that David's in there. And David has the chance to kill the king of Israel, King Saul. But instead of that, he lets Saul keep going. And we learned in that moment about David's extreme integrity and what a great example he was. And then last week we talked about David's moments of anxiety and how in his moments when he was stressed and panicked and worried, he turned to God, and he even wrote about his dependence on God in those moments. There were a lot of episodes in David's life where he could have done something that would have saved his neck in everybody else's eyes, or he could have done something that would have made his life easier, and he chose instead to say, God, what do you want me to do? I mean, time and time again, he's been a great example, but he did have a serious vulnerability. In fact, in a very real sense, it was exactly the vulnerability that Samuel, the prophet who anointed David as king, had promised the people would be true of all of their kings. All right? When Samuel was asked, when all of the people were begging Samuel, please appoint a king for us, Samuel came back and told him, he said, listen, there's something you don't understand. He said, the standard operating procedure of kings is to take from you whatever they want, whenever they want it. And they said, we don't care. We just want to be like everybody else. We want to have a king. He says, you're going to regret this. I'm telling you. And the thing is, when David became king, he was guilty of this same thing. And for David, it was most obvious in the way that he treated and used women in his life. Because you can't tell the story of David without telling the story of his tragically unhealthy pattern of marital and sexual behavior with dozens or hundreds of women, time and time again. David used his power, he used his influence, he used his position to force women into his bedroom, and it turned out to be the weakest aspect of his character. It didn't have to be that way. It didn't have to be a weakness for David. David could have, with reliance on God, he could have decided to be an example for us, a story that we could tell even today about purity in his relation with women. But that's not what happened, because David let his guard down. In this area of his life, David decided not to put his defenses up, and the forces of evil in the spiritual realm shot their flaming arrows at David at his weakest spot. And the tragic result impacted much more than just David's life. In fact, there's a particular episode that's recorded in the Old Testament book of 2 Samuel, chapter 11. And in this story, David ends up creating a huge mess. By the time this story happens, David has become king. He's been king for a while. His country is in the middle of a war. But for the first time in his leadership story, the first time in his career, he did not go to war with the army. He just sent the army off to war, left his generals in charge. He stayed back kind of by himself, you know, just with his attendants and all of that. And he didn't have much that he was doing. He was kind of just killing time. And so the story says that one night he gets up out of bed. He goes for a walk on the balcony of the palace in the evening. And from his high vantage point, and he's got one of the only multi-story buildings in the city. I mean, he's the only person who can see from his vantage point. And he sees across town, he sees a woman bathing in the courtyard of her own house, where she had a reasonable expectation of some privacy, but she didn't realize that she was being watched. And he didn't know who she was, but he decided he wanted to send somebody to go and find out. And so when he sends his messengers and they come back and report who lives at that particular address, he finds out that the woman he's been watching bathe is actually the wife of one of his elite soldiers. I mean, not just a random person. This is the wife of one of the people that later in Scripture would be called one of David's mighty men, one of his elite 30 guys that were closest to him, most devoted to his cause and to his kingdom. They were people who were absolutely supportive of everything that David was trying to do. And David finds out that it's that guy's wife, Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, who he's been watching take a bath. And the story says after he found out that it was the wife of one of his most dedicated men, the text says he sent messengers to go get her. Not to invite her, to get her and to bring her back. And they brought her back to the palace. And the story says he slept with her and then he sent her back home. Now, of course, David knew better than this. David knew better. This is not just an instance of a historic moment or an ancient practice that offends our modern morality. David knew that this was evil. In fact, David also knew that this was illegal. According to the Israelite law in Deuteronomy chapter 22, if David hadn't been the king, he likely would have been killed because of what he did with Bathsheba. But he was the king. He had the power. He had all of the control. He was not guarding his own mind. He wasn't thinking about the good of his citizens. He dropped his defenses. He dropped the shield of faith that had previously governed so many of his decisions. He ignored God's law. He ignored his conscience. He ignored that inner voice of conviction that says, I shouldn't be doing this. He dropped his guard, and the enemy shot an arrow of temptation at David's most vulnerable point, and it hit exactly where it was supposed to hit. It was terrible. Tragic story. But the story wasn't over. A few weeks later, the story tells us that word came to the palace from a messenger through a messenger from Bathsheba, and Bathsheba says she was pregnant. And immediately in that moment, rather than listening to the voice of conscience or conviction, David went into cover-up operation mode. He sent word to the war front and told Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, to come home for some R&R. And he tries to create or control the narrative in a way that makes it sound as if Uriah and Bathsheba are going to have a baby together. But that plan fails. And so then when David sends Uriah back to the battle zone, he sends Uriah carrying his own death warrant, a sealed letter to hand to the commander that says, next time y'all are in a battle, next time there's a combat moment, I want you to withdraw from Uriah and allow him to be killed out on the battlefield. David signed Uriah's death sentence, and then he brought Bathsheba back to the palace to be his wife. Now you got to know, you got to understand that all of this happened, the voyeurism, the manipulation, the assault of Bathsheba, the murder of Uriah, all of this happened because David let down his guard. He made an idol out of sexuality, an idol out of power, and he gave that idol a place of higher importance in his life than his own faith had. In the past, when he had trusted in God in moments of danger and anxiety and loneliness, he had been an example of what it was like to lead with faith. In the moments in his life in the past when he had faced such challenging circumstances and threats and things that would have terrified anybody, he leaned into God and he showed himself to be an example of dependence on God in faith. But in this moment of sexual temptation, the story says he shed his spiritual armor that God had provided for him. It was like a firefighter walking into a fire in his street clothes. David completely shed the protection that God had blessed him with and what he had used and to honor God with his life all of those years. And in that moment, David devolved from being a protector of the weak to being predator on the weak. He abused his power. He abused his citizens. He behaved as if his desires were the only thing that mattered. He was a king in a spiritual battle for his own mind and for the heart of his nation. And he walked in with no armor. He walked in totally unprepared. Now, it's not difficult to come up with a list of things he should have done different, right? I mean, perhaps he should have been leading the army rather than staying at home. Perhaps he should have been on the mission that God had called him to defend his country and defend his nation against all the threats against the people of God. Certainly he should have looked the other way and allowed Bathsheba some privacy when he saw her bathing. If he had taken either one of those two preemptive steps, he would have preoccupied himself with the mission or rejected the temptation of a second glance at the woman. If either of those two steps had been taken, the story would have turned out different. But David let his guard down. David decided not to listen. Not to be faithful to what God would have him do. Not to lead into his life with faith. But he dropped his guard. He was missing his shield. He was missing his spiritual armor. And armor is critical. There's a story I read from some Air Force chronicles about World War II that I thought was fascinating. The story goes that Allied forces were trying to figure out a way, and I know some of you Lockheed people are going to tell me I got this plane wrong. I already know, okay? Mark Porter, I already know. But I've been told, the first service people told me I got the plane wrong. But the story goes that in World War II, they were desperately trying to figure out a way to better armor the bombers that were making bombing runs over Germany. Because, I mean, the statistics were terrible. They were losing almost as many planes on the bombing missions as they were saving. And it was almost to the point where it was rare for a bomber to be able to make it back after going on a bombing run over Germany. And the commanders knew. They said, we've got to add more armor to these planes, but the armor is so heavy, we can't just put armor over the whole thing. It'll make it where it won't be able to fly and it won't be able to carry bombs. And so we've got to be able to plan. We've got to figure out the right places on the plane to put the armor. And so what they started doing was they started studying the bullet hole patterns on the planes that came back. All right. So every time a plane would show back up after a mission, they would really painstakingly get in there and they would chronicle all of the places where the bullets had hit that plane. And they're thinking to themselves, we'll figure out where the anti-aircraft guns are being effective, where they're hitting these planes, and we'll armor there. And so they looked at this pattern and they started to notice that there really was a pattern of where the bullets were hitting, you know, out here on the wings and right in the center area of the fuselage. And on the tail flaps as well. And so they figured out the pattern and what it looked like, and they started making plans to start putting more armor on those places, the wings and the center of the fuselage and the tail flaps. But there was a problem with their analysis, and it finally was pointed out by a statistician named Abraham Vald, and he pointed out the problem. He says, you know, the deal is we've only looked at the bullet hole patterns on the planes that made it back, right? He says, we haven't been looking at the bullet hole patterns on the planes that went down. In fact, this pattern is really a map of places on the plane that it can take a bullet and still get home safely, right? And so then they had to totally change their strategy. They had to totally change their approach. And they took their bullet hole analysis and they reinforced all the black areas. They reinforced the cockpit. They reinforced the engine. And the result was fewer fatalities and a greater success on the bombing mission. What they needed was to shield the part of the plane that was most vulnerable to catastrophic damage, right? They didn't need to shield the parts that the plane could fly even if it had bullet holes there. They needed to shield the parts where the plane was going to go down if it got hit. And I think you and I can learn a whole lot from this strategy. Because as Paul is telling us in Ephesians, our faith is under fire. Our faith is under attack. He describes it as the evil one shooting, firing, flaming arrows at us. And you know, there's going to be some times in your life when the enemy shoots an arrow at you and you're like, I'm not even fazed by that. That just goes right on by. Or it hits you in a part of your life where you're just feeling so close to God and so connected that it doesn't even bother you. You're like, that all you got, Satan? And then they shoot at you again. And there's times in your life, there's moments in your life, there's transitions in your life, there's places in your life, there's characteristics of your spiritual life where you're vulnerable, right? Because we all have our own temptations that we're susceptible to. We have our own sinful inclinations. We carry our own baggage. We carry our own doubts with us. We have unique fears. We have unique anxieties. Every single person in this room is vulnerable to different forms of spiritual attack, right? Every single one of us is vulnerable in different ways. And you probably can admit to yourself that if a flaming arrow from the evil one was to strike you in just the right spot, if it was to cause just the right loss, just the right anxiety, just the right doubt, just the right problem in your life, it would cause a lot of damage to your spiritual life. Which is why Paul insists that we arm ourselves with a shield of faith that's capable of extinguishing the flaming arrows that Satan shoots at us. He insists we've got to arm ourselves with this shield of faith and this helmet of salvation. We have got to use the tools, use the equipment that God has provided for us to be able to stand firm in the battle, to be able to resist the attacks. Now here's what I want to tell you. We have something. We have something that David didn't have. We have something that makes all the difference in the world if we'll use it. We have the gospel and the lordship of Jesus Christ, don't we? I mean, it's incredible. And I'm telling you today, I'm going to tell you this shield of faith that works in your life, that extinguishes the flaming arrows of Satan that are thrown at you, is loyalty to Jesus. It's enough to extinguish any flaming arrow that comes your way. It might be an arrow of doubt that comes into your life when you start to question everything you've ever thought, everything you've ever believed, everything you were taught, and everything you thought you ever knew. It could be an arrow like that. And I'm telling you, loyalty to Jesus in that moment will extinguish that doubt. It may be an arrow of loneliness or a terrifying circumstance that happens in your life. It may be an arrow of intense temptation that seems like it won't leave you alone. It keeps coming back over and over and over again. And Paul would tell you, loyalty and faith and belief in Jesus in that moment will extinguish that arrow that's been shot at you. It could be a tragedy in your life. We know that story all too well. Or it could be a great success in your life that makes you stop depending on others because you feel like you've got this on your own. It makes you think too highly of yourself. There's all these different arrows that are being fired at us, and Paul is trying to tell us, carry with you the shield of faith, because when those flaming arrows come in, it'll put them out. No matter which one is fired at you, loyalty to Jesus will extinguish that arrow, because as the scripture says time and time and time again, God is a shield to those who seek refuge in Him. Jesus Himself is our shield against the attacks. No arrow can pierce, no weapon can penetrate the protection of Jesus Christ in our lives. And so we take our refuge behind Jesus. We take our refuge and we follow behind Jesus into every single day. He is the protective equipment that we walk behind into the fire, through the waters. Jesus is the equipment that God has given us to succeed and to remain standing in the battle against our faith. The sword, the shield of faith, and the helmet of salvation. These things guard our minds with the confident knowledge that Jesus is the King. Jesus has rescued us from the ultimate enemy. And it would be foolish to go through any day in your life. It would be foolish to go through the day-to-day of your life without the equipment that God provides for your good. You know, there are moments in your life when you're more vulnerable. Moments in your life when it's most critical. As I've been thinking about all of the folks I've been seeing wearing graduation cap and gowns the last couple of weeks on Facebook, right? Everybody who's transitioning into a new school, transitioning into a new stage of life, transitioning into a new job, moving from one part of their life and their education process to another. I'm thinking about all the transitions that are happening and how that's a moment when you're particularly vulnerable. Because there's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of things to be concerned about. There's a lot of new introductions. There's loneliness. There's all kinds of features of those kinds of transitions in your life that can be really scary. And I wonder, how are you armoring yourself? How are you armoring your plane for that kind of transition? There's times in your life when you feel as if the foundation of your faith is a little shaky. Maybe it's because you've experienced loss. Maybe it's because things haven't worked out the way that you thought or hoped that they would. Maybe it's because of extreme disappointment. And I wonder, how are you armoring yourself? How are you armoring your plane for that moment? Paul says that day's coming. Those days when the evil one is on the attack, those days are coming in your life. But you don't have to be blindsided by that. You can be prepared for that.